Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome in, friends, to the Jazz Mill Broadcast, a celebration of all things jazz, featuring the great music of and interviews with some of the hottest singers and players on the planet. As always, your calls and feedback are welcome. Now, your host, Scott Henderson.
Yes, sirree, Bobcat Tail. Welcome in, jazz lovers, to the Jazz Mill Podcast. Hey, here's a fun fact for you. Did you know that researchers at Oxford University recently found a correlation between high IQ and those who dig jazz? And that the more people listen to jazz, the smarter they became, which is very good news for a guy like me. On top of that, the overwhelming majority of jazz lovers floss daily. They change their motor oil every 3,000 miles, and they're also kind to small animals. Like the man says, I'm your host, Scott Henderson. For about the next hour or so, we're going to do our level best to entertain you with great music and great interviews with the hottest players, singers, composers, and authors on the planet. As always, we invite your calls at 515-602-9600. That's 515-602-9600, or you can make some new friends in our chat room if you care to. Hey, well, let's punch up my Jazz Mill cohort, Greg Rockingham, who has been keeping the beat since he was about 5 years old. He is an alumnus of the prestigious Interlochen Arts Academy and Northeastern University. He's worked with everyone from Glenn Miller to Steely Dan. Presently, he plays with the Soul Message Band, and they are the hottest B3 combo east of the Mississippi, in my humble opinion. Can be heard weekly at Chicago's historic Green Mill and elsewhere in the Chicagoland area. Welcome in, G-Rock. How are you, friend?
I'm really good. Nice to talk to you. And hello, Scott. Let me get that in before
Scott
we get along.
He is looming. He is on deck, and he is excited, I think, to be here. We couldn't be more excited. Talk about a great guest. He's Scott Yano, we're referring to, and he is the quintessential jazz author, historian, and reviewer. You've seen his names if you are a student or a lover of jazz. He's authored 12 books on the topic. He's written over 900 liner notes, more than 20,000 reviews, and countless interviews with the masters of the genre. So today and next week at the same time, we're going to take a deep dive into his latest book, Life Through the Eyes of a Jazz Journalist, which I heartily recommend. It is a fast read, and I can tell you it is loaded with wonderful anecdotes and all kinds of things that will interest folks that would take to this show. Scott, welcome in, friend. How are you?
Well, fine. Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're excited, and I ask this rhetorically, how is it possible that a man who's dedicated most of his adult life to the furtherance of jazz was born on a day when not even a single jazz recording took place, according to Tom Lord's discography? Can you figure that out for me?
Well, I guess that way you had to hide my head. I don't know. Well, it's funny. I look up that date, October 4th in 1950.
Yeah,
nothing took place. So it's weird.
Well, they left space for you, I guess, is the idea there. Might be one way to look at that. Now, boy, what a contribution you have made. I mean, you have shaped opinion, and you have informed, and you have created interest, and you've certainly helped grow this music. And that's one of the great things that we hope to accomplish with the Jazz Mill Broadcast, is just bringing jazz to more people, good jazz. And I know it's your opinion that I think you once said that you listen to all kinds of music as long as it's jazz. So I'd ask you to maybe talk a little bit, if you would, just to kind of go back before we go forward, talk a little bit about the early days, your early exposures to jazz. For a lot of us, it was on television. We'd get little glimpses, and then, you know, more and more we became interested. But if you wouldn't mind talking about that and maybe a little bit about, you know, the Strictly from Dixie show that I know was helpful to you.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I didn't really hear much jazz at all until I was almost 16. I mean, I saw the movie The Five Pennies, which was a movie on Red Nichols' life that Danny Kaye playing the lead part and Louis Armstrong in it. And I loved the joy of jazz that was throughout the movie. But beyond that, I really didn't hear any until I happened to discover that through a notice in the Los Angeles Times that there was a Dixieland show on the radio from 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. And I really can't imagine that being true today, you know, where the whole hour was just taken up by New Orleans jazz.
Yeah.
And I started listening
right.
to that. And within a few days, you know, I really just loved it because it's like the world's happiest music. And so I pretty much got addicted to that. And that was the start for me.
Yeah, and a good one it was. You seem to make a case in the book about listening to older jazz or formative jazz or Dixieland jazz first as a person gets acquainted with the genre. Do you have more to add to that?
Well, that's just how it happened to work for me because I went from that to 1920s jazz and then swing and then getting through the door of bebop, you know, through Charlie Parker. But you know, most people, of course, discover jazz through something that's much more modern. I mean, they would have gotten into it. Maybe they listened to rock and they got into it from fusion, which, you know, say Return to Forever,
yes.
Weather Report, or something that's more recent. So
yeah.
That's a gap with me that I am going through it chronologically.
Yeah, I think you know, arguably it's a little easier to the ear, a little more consumable perhaps. Dixieland is, its tempos are pretty easy to follow, and a lot of the tunes are you know, pretty hummable and memorable, and I think it can be a nice way to kind of get your feet wet as you inch your way towards some of the more complicated modern jazz stuff. I think. And Greg, you'd probably agree that's where, you know, some people don't seem to hang with jazz. They get an earful of Coltrane or somebody that's playing a lot of complicated stuff with complicated time signatures, and they're like, well, that's not for me. I couldn't make any sense of it. So they throw their hands up, and I think it takes a special patience to muscle your way through some of that stuff, and I include myself, by the by. But, hey, let's listen. You had a good suggestion, Scott, as we were preparing for this show. We're going to give you an example. People hear Dixieland all the time, but what does that sound like? So we're going to give you a quick example of that.
Thank you.
Nice. That's good stuff. Makes you toe tap, doesn't it, guys? Eddie Condon and his band, and you hear that little drum lick at the end there, Greg. I bet that made you happy. Good stuff. And if you don't like that, I'm going to politely refer to your physician. You know, goodness gracious, that's just universally interesting and fun. So from there, Scott, you were off to college, and you happened to be on a dorm, had a dorm room amid a bunch of musicians, and they exposed you and taught the types of jazz, modern jazz and other types. And before you knew it, you found yourself editor of a newly formed magazine, The Record Review. How did that all come about, if you don't mind telling us that story?
Oh, sure. I had a friend in college, Brian Ashley, who thought it'd be a great idea to have a new magazine, a music magazine that covered rock, country, jazz, and classical music. So, the original idea was, well, we'll sell it for 10 cents and we'll make a million, but of course distributors didn't really want that. But after, early 1977, we decided to take a chance, put it out, and that was called Record Review. And I was the jazz editor, so I basically started it at the top. And I just reviewed whatever, at that time, LPs that came out, that looked interesting. And it gave me a lot of experience. I did that for 7 years before, when I could see that the end was coming near for Record Review, that I sent out these reviews to other magazines and, pretty much accelerated from there.
Yeah, and across the spectrum, you built a name for yourself, Scott. And I want to read, if you'll indulge me. I think it's your first review. You reviewed a Cedar Walton Hank Mobley tune called Breakthrough, if you remember that. It says here, these are your words, "Breakthrough brings back memories of the famous jam sessions of the 50s. Five very underrated musicians have recorded an album that not only looks back 15 years, but also looks ahead to the future. The title track, Breakthrough, is a summary of the 50s. After the melody is stated, Charles Davis begins a long, only slightly modernized baritone solo straight from that decade. Then comes Hank Mobley. Listen to the Charlie Parker-ish licks. The rhythm section is very present but not intruding. During his spectacular solo, Sam Jones sounds very much like Ray Brown during this segment. When Mobley concludes, Cedar Walton plays his expert imitation of Bud Powell." So, clearly, you knew your stuff even then, Scott. I mean, you had a great command of language, composition, and player comparison, and all very impressive. And for that to be your first work, you must have known you were on to something.
Well, I knew I loved the music and wanted to help it. That's always been the goal, to increase the audience and to get, and also for my own sake, just getting to hear everything. That's been the goal. I wanted to get every good jazz record and have a chance to actually hear it. So I'm still working on that.
Basically,
I'm just a record collector, really, at heart, and I just wanted to hear, the best music by the best players.
Yeah, and you probably had access to, I know you have a record collection that is enviable. What would you guess it's up to at this point? I know it was over 5,000 at one point.
Oh, 5,000. Well, that was a long time ago. I have the exact number. I have the exact number written down. Because it changes hourly, it seems. But the CDs and LPs, it's over 64,000.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Well, that may be the foremost collection in North America, maybe in the world for that matter. Now, that's very cool, and I'm sure you keep them all in a safe place. So let's hope you do. It occurs to me that there are skills in common when you're writing reviews and liner notes and articles, but would you agree that interviewing an artist is a whole other kettle of fish? It just seems like it's quite a different set of skills required. Would you agree with that?
Well, there's a certain amount of skills involved. You know, you just want to prepare beforehand. You want to have an idea what the, you know, of the artist's work. And also, you know, when you do the interview, you want to keep it open, you know, in case they come up with a different idea or take it in a different direction. And, you know, let them talk. And then you know, you have to sort of have an idea what you want out of the interview, if it's based on their life story or if it's based on the newest record. You know, the basic plot of the interview, you have that idea in mind beforehand, but then, you know, you let it be open and improvise to a certain extent.
Absolutely. Think on your feet. Follow-up questions. You mentioned a few that you felt particularly good about, enjoyable to you. I think Freddie Hubbard was among them that you talk about in Life Through the Eyes of a Jazz Journalist. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that discussion.
The interview was kind of funny. You know, actually, I put three long interviews in from the 70s in the book, you know, Freddie Hubbard's career in Maine and Ferguson. And the reason I put him in is because it really shows their personalities. In the case of Freddie Hubbard, it's funny because, you know, I interviewed him at Columbia Records, and he was supposed to be talking about his new album, but he didn't like his new album. So basically, he was cutting down the producer, Bob James, and saying, "Oh, I'm not going to do a record like this again," you know, which I'm sure, you know, the Columbia executives really liked
him. Love that.
So basically, you know, I got him to talk about topics that he didn't normally talk about, like, you know, being a roommate with Eric Dolphy and being on Ornette Coleman's Free Jazz, and, you know, what do you remember about Coltrane? And in addition to Art Blakey and Max Roach and many of the other players in the 60s who he happened to play with, and he was happy with that. It's just funny because, you know, you get him talking about his current stuff, and he was saying, "Oh, that's good," you know. You know, he wasn't too complimentary. And the joke is, you know, he said, "Oh, I'm not going to do a record like that again." And then his next few records for Columbia were pretty similar.
Oh, no,
so
kidding.
He didn't follow his own advice. Yeah.
Well, they might have, some of the execs might have had something to say about it. Who knows? But, that's interesting. That's really interesting. You mentioned Maynard Ferguson a second ago. Greg, I know you mentioned a while ago that you had a Maynard Ferguson, call it a run-in or an experience. You care to share that with us?
Yes. Kind of doesn't compare to what the story that Scott Yanow is talking about right now, but I'll go ahead. I went to high school at Interlochen with two of Maynard Ferguson's kids. Bentley was one kid, and then a daughter named Kim Ferguson. And what was tragic about the story with Bentley, of course, when everyone found out that Maynard Ferguson's son was coming to Interlochen, all the trumpet players were couldn't wait to meet him and just all excited about it. But the sad part was Bentley didn't play trumpet, and he was just beginning to play trumpet, but there was so much pressure on him. And afterwards, he ended up committing suicide, and that was a sad story. Kim Ferguson, she fared better, and she even managed Maynard's band for a while. But then years later, we did a jazz cruise, and someone from the Jazz Showcase sent this picture. But I told Maynard I went to kids with this school. I mean, went to school with his kids, and then we sat one night, like in the corner of the ship somewhere, and him and I just talked all night long, and it was just an incredible to be in the company of someone like that. But he was extremely nice. His band, that particular band was the smaller, like I think it was called the Nouveau, or it was a little bit smaller than a big band, but
I see.
He was just incredible to talk to, and very, very down to earth and nice, and we just sat and talked. And he just answered every question, and he leaned over to his wife and said, "Hey, he went to school with Kim and Bentley," and it was just a wonderful conversation. But a sad story about Bentley, you know.
Yeah, that's a sad chapter for sure. But, it's interesting. Scott, and we've talked to a lot of people. You do too, more, way more. But it's a great league of gentlemen and ladies are the jazz players out there, the composers and the artists is what we're finding. And you among them, I know there are others beyond the three that you mentioned here. I know you had a sit down with Steve Allen, who was a prolific songwriter. What was that like?
Oh, it was kind of funny because it's like he wrote the article for me. He you know, some people talk in complete sentences. He talks in complete paragraphs. He'd give you the entire story, you know, and you wouldn't want to change a word because it's there.
Steve Allen
was kind of fascinating because he probably wrote more songs than just about anybody in the world ever.
Yeah, I've read
because,
that.
You know, he would have contests where people would bet him he couldn't write 100 songs in a month, and he would do it. But, of course, you know, he also wrote more forgotten songs than anybody because he only had one hit. you know, this could be the start of something big.
Right.
He probably wrote 50,000 songs, and 49,000 were forgotten immediately. But no, he was brilliant. You know, he had so many different talents, and he loved jazz, and he featured jazz on his shows in the '50s. You know, on TV.
And in the sixties,
he had Terry Gibbs as his band leader on the shows, and he would be part of the show rather than just doing one song or something. They would be playing things behind the guests quite often, and sometimes they'd break.
That was quite a big innovation, wasn't it, Scott? I mean, I don't know, there may not have been other shows doing that. Certainly, he was one of the great thinkers. I've thought he would be a good guy to, if you had to pick somebody from our history to have dinner with, I bet you Steve Allen would be a fun guy to cozy up with. Dave Brubeck was another one that you seem to have a lot to say in the book about. Tell us there what your experiences were, please.
Well, he was one of the nicest guys. You know, him, Clark Terry, and Louis Belson, and a few others, which was, you know, just really, really kind people. And in the case of Dave Brubeck, I mean, he certainly didn't need the publicity. I was interviewing him for Jazz Is, and, you know, he'd been famous for 45, 50 years already, and But he was just so nice. He answered all the questions. And afterwards, after the article came out, he sent me like two letters thanking me for it. And he also gave me a phone call and, you know, thanked me. And he didn't need to do any of that because everybody knew who Dave Brubeck was. But he was just, that was just how he was. Yeah.
Good guy. And a lot of his sons, I think, played with him in some of the later years. That's when I saw him. In South Florida, and a couple of his sons were playing different instruments in the band, and what a beautiful show they did. Still had plenty of game left, that was for sure. It just confirms, you know, my belief that most of these guys are just terrific. I'm going to ask you, they couldn't have all gone smoothly. There must have been a clinker or two in there. Would you mind talking a little bit about ones that were a little bit awkward? Let's use that word.
There are times when they want to talk about a particular topic and it had nothing to do with what the article was going to be. And, you know, I mentioned that in the book. I mean, Stanley Jordan only wants to talk about computers. And this was 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So it would have been way out of date.
Yeah.
And Abdullah Ibrahim only wanted to talk about religion. So that didn't go very long either.
No.
But, you know, what do you do?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think I have enough here for the article, right? I just imagine it's just a numbers game, right? But if you do enough of them, you're going to get mostly good, but you're going to get a couple in there that, make you wonder. But in the interest of time here, Scott, I want to make sure that we get to some of the festival work that you have done. I think that'll take us kind of to the roughly the halfway point in our two-part series here. But I want to play an example, you know, people listening to this, not all of them have our, you know, depth of understanding of, you know, what is modern jazz, what's Dixieland, all that. I want to give an example of a Parker tune. Charlie Parker, great horn player, as covered here by a guy named Monty Alexander, who you're probably familiar with, Scott. I know, Greg, you are. But he does a beautiful version that I'll play for you called Now Is the Time. Thank you. That's how we do that. fun stuff. We are visiting with Scott Yanow, the reviewer, historian extraordinaire. He has a new book out, which I heartily recommend, Life Through the Eyes of a Jazz Journalist. It is loaded with great anecdotes, make a great stocking stuffer. And we're going to be giving one away each week as we head up to the big day, Christmas Day. And if you're the first person to retweet our show link after broadcast on Twitter, we will see that you get an autographed copy from Scott Yanow himself. So, Scott, now I teased the festival work that you have done. I think you may hold the record for the most consecutive years covering the Playboy Jazz Festival at 41. Is that the number?
Yes.
And could you share some of your recollections there? I know you made a grand entrance one time that you describe in the book that made me laugh hard.
Oh, well, you know, I've been to every single Playboy Festival, so I guess that I would have to, at worst, you know, tie the record with somebody. But no, they used to have a press conference at the Playboy Mansion, like in April, in March or April of a few months before the festival took place. And so, you know, one year I went, you know, I was really first time I was invited, and I went there in my old broken down car, and you know, couldn't wait to go. And then I get there, and there was a bump in the road, and I went over it, and immediately the muffler fell out of my car, and it was pouring rain. So, but you know, I didn't want to, so much of being overconfident. So I just pulled the muffler out from the ground, put it in the back seat, and then, you know, just parked as if nothing happened. Because I was a little flooded, but you know. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I would imagine. You got to do what you got to do, right? We've all had that car. I want to say, you mentioned you had, I think your first car, did you say in the book, was a Chevy Vega? And if that's true, we are brothers from another mother. Is that true?
Yeah, that was true. You know, and it lasted about 3 years.
What color was it?
Oh, it was kind of. Kind of tan.
I think we had the same Vega, Scott. And mine ended up
with
well, I wouldn't say that. It ended up burning up. I don't know. I had some sort of a fuel line leak, and I got out of it just in time to watch it go up in a big flaming heap. But I think I got about a year out of it. And then paved the way for me to you'll get a kick out of this. I went on from the Chevy Vega, maybe even worse, I'm not sure, to the AMC Pacer. Do you remember the Pacer?
Just vaguely, you know. I was never cars really.
Yeah, well, it was a mess. It was, it again was not particularly sound mechanically. Greg, you may remember the Pacer, but it was all windows. And living in South Florida, you don't want all windows in your car because it's like a solar collector on wheels. But I had a little better luck with that, mechanically speaking. But I digress. I want to ask you, there's always a debate in my mind, you know, where are the lines between, as we finish up with you, Scott, well, where are the lines between jazz and pop and rock? And with my wife, I came up last night with a few artists that, you know, I kind of have in my head as tweeners, you know, depending on what they're playing or covering or whatever, could be considered an artist that could, you know, have a foot in each genre, say rock and roll and jazz. And the first one, I bet a lot of people would say, Steely Dan comes to mind. I mean, what would you say? Are they a tweener for you, or are they one or the other?
oh, well, you know, a lot of jazz people like their music. To me, they're basically a rock group that utilizes some jazz people, you know, on various records.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's jazz influence.
Yeah.
But the idea, you know, the definition of what jazz is, it's very difficult to come up with one because jazz has the most creative musicians in the world. So if you come up with a definition, they're going to immediately violate it and, you know, come up with a different way of doing it.
That's true.
And because jazz draws its music and its influences all over the world in all different kinds of styles, there's always music that's just on the borderline. You know, it could be considered jazz or world music, or maybe it's a blues, or maybe it's rock or pop.
Yeah.
And so basically, you know, the qualities I look for in jazz is just that if someone plays a song one day and if a week later it's exactly the same, then it's probably not so jazz oriented. If they're improvising and if they're changing the music and being creative, then that's, but of course that's really vague. So, you know, I mean,
yeah,
I don't know why jazz always has this problem, because I would think, say, country music, they, you know, they're not really, you know, they don't seem to have a problem over what country is, or pop or rock. But jazz, they always seem to have a difficulty trying to define it.
People,
I don't know.
People want to put it in a category. They want it, you know, clearly delineated what it is. And you know, you could argue that bluegrass is as much jazz as jazz is, right? I mean, if you're talking about trading solos, and you know, there's just a whole lot of commonality there. But you once said that the best jazz is unpredictable, filled with potential danger and surprises, and is therefore endlessly exciting, like watching a high wire act, which I agree with altogether. I'll tell you a quick little story. I was at a club here in Chicago you might be familiar with called the Jazz Showcase, and Jeff Hamilton was in town, and he was working with the DuPaul Big Band and an ensemble of maybe 20 guys, young players, you know, then he was working with them and, you know, kind of passing the torch to them, so to speak. And the young tenor player stood up and began taking a couple of laps in a particular song, and he kind of muffed it up, and in the blink of an eye, I saw this happen. And this is the high wire act part of it that I was talking about. Hamilton caught the band leader's eye, and they waved him around again. And the kid took another couple of choruses, and he found his footing, and he played beautifully. And it was really wonderful to see. And it was just this generosity, and you know, but you put yourself out there every time you take the stand and take a solo, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's different than, say, classical, where every note's written out, and you basically know what it's going to sound like. In jazz, you know, even if it's arranged, people take solos, and it can be a complete flop. But most of the time, you know, it succeeds. And, you know, really the way to judge it is it colorful, and does it interest you, and, you know, does it hold your interest, really? That's how you know, I mean, once it's above a certain level of musicianship, and, you know, they're all pretty much all great musicians to a certain extent, you know, the professionals, then it's just a matter of colorful or is it boring, you know, and if it's boring, then it's a failure, and it's colorful, then it succeeds. And that's really the way, you know, that's what I say to people that are not necessarily musicians, you know, that's how you judge music. Does it interest you or not, you know?
Yeah, simple as that, right? Does it catch you on some level? You don't have to doesn't have to fit in a box. Do you like it? Does it catch your ear? And you know, when we think about great music, you know, we're all of us on this call are big fans of the Great American Songbook, and I have supposed recently that is a fluid. Call it a list. I mean, it too is sort of a hard thing to define. I mean, I know it's tunes from the 20s to the 60s roughly, but why must it be calendar bound? I contend that there have been many songs after the 60s and up to date that are becoming worthy of the Great American Songbook standards in their own right. So I think it's, you know, presumptuous to box them in. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, except that, you know, it's a little more difficult for songs of today to get heard and played by dozens of musicians. It's, you know, I mean, what are the great songs of the last 10 years? It's difficult, you know, because there are a lot of really good originals written by jazz musicians, but they're not necessarily covered by many others. And so it's a tricky thing because in the older days, you know, they would be in Broadway shows, they'd be in movies, and you had a dozen really remarkable songwriters who constantly churned out all these classics. And that nowadays it's so scattered that, you know, if a real good trumpeter from Finland writes a great song, you know, it might not be recorded by one, two, or three people. So it's kind of tricky.
Yeah. No, I hear you. If the yardstick is number of covers, then yeah, you've got a good point. I'm so thankful to people like a mutual friend of ours, Elijah Rock. He's been on. He was on recently. He's carrying the torch for the Great American Songbook, and I think a very interesting way. I think you may have reviewed some of his works. He even does one with Nashville musicians, and it's got a real southern twang to it, a country twang to it. And by God, it works. At least it did for Greg and I. And another one that you may know, Nita Freelon, who is just a delight, and she does a whole lot with standards, and she regards the Great American Songbook in the same way that we do. So, yeah, I think we all want to further it in any way that we can and open ears to this wonderful form of music, and I know you do that. Scott, probably more than any living American, you are banging the bell, brother, and I can't tell you how thrilled it is for me to, you know, be able to call you a friend and, you know, have you on these airwaves to promote your good works. Now and downstream, we will help you. You've written 12 books. I've got some ideas for future content if you're not tired of writing, and I just know there's so much more. You know, you wrote this as your memoirs, but I presume there'll be a part two to this. I know your wife suggested you write it now so you don't forget the great stories. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Well, I always tell musicians they should do that too. You know, if you're around the jazz world for a long period of time, you know, you hear a lot, you experience a lot, and you hear a lot you hear a lot of funny stories and interesting stories along the way, and if you don't write them down, they're going to be lost. So
they're
going to really
be lost.
The book.
Yeah. Well, you're a vessel. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I didn't want these stories to be completely forgotten because some of them I only experienced myself, or I only remember myself. You know, at certain concerts, certain wisecracks that are made on stage, and those kind of things. And so I started writing it down, and that way, you know, decades from now, someone can, you know, look up and see what John Faddis said when Freddie Hubbard was late one time, and you know, those kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the delicious stuff for a, you know, a non-player like myself. I so wish I could play something like Greg can and like others can, and but I can't. So I listen. I listen with great intensity, and I love the in between stuff. That's to me is where the marrow is, and you're helping us keep that alive. I mean, you're a vessel, aren't you? When you talk to these artists and they share a detail with you like that, I mean, it could die with them unless you do something with it. So I know you get that, and I know you accept that responsibility. This book is evidence of that. And like I said before, I want our listeners to gobble it up. It's available on Amazon, and it is just delightful. I read it in two sittings, and I kid you not, it's The Life Through the Eyes of a Jazz Journalist, My Jazz Memoirs by Scott Yanow. And you will find it there. And if you would like to participate in our giveaway, we're going to do at least one a week right up until Christmas. And we'll tell you how to do that this week. You just need to be the first one to retweet our show link after we come off air today, and we will send one in your direction. But it's wonderful reading, and you will come out of it smarter, and you know, it is sad for the soul in these difficult times. I mean, I know we're all still you know, everybody's wrestling with something, and music is such a curative, Scott. I think you'd agree, and for me, it is. It's a great form of therapy, and I'm so glad to have it in my life. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for what you're doing. And I'm already looking forward to part two of our visit, which will be next week at the same time. It's 4 Central if you want to catch us live. I think it's 2 o'clock your time, Scott. On the West Coast, and people can hear this broadcast anytime after we air initially. So it's available 10 minutes after we come off today. And you just go to Blog Talk, BLOGTALK, and type in the Jazz Mill, and you'll see all of our archives shows there, and you can listen to any one among them. To include this one, it will be there here in about 25 minutes. So, Scott, thank you so much for this. Everything I'd hoped it would be, and until we speak again, sir, I will wish you well. Keep on swinging. I know you will.
Oh, sure. And thanks a lot for having me. And you know, thanks for helping to promote jazz, because the music's really for everybody. I've always thought, you know, you don't need a music degree to enjoy jazz. All you have to do is just have ears and open mind.
You got that right.
That's
it takes a village.
Before you go, I want to ask Scott a question. I want to make a comment real quick, and I want to ask him a question.
Please.
There's October 4th is an important day, because my wife's birthday is October 4th. So, caught my eye. But I wanted to ask Scott, does he remember, because I used to love this when I was growing up, do you remember the Oscar Peterson show? He had his own television show with Oscar Peterson, of course, piano, and Ray Brown, and the great Bobby Durham on drums. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw – well, they were being broadcast here in the 80s. I taped about 10 of them, you know, I mean, on the video recorder. Yeah, yeah, that was a great show, because he'd always have a guest each time. And, you know, there was some remarkable to see there. And Oscar Peterson was still fine at the time. So, yeah, those were great.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Okay, but I enjoyed listening to your stories and your point of view with Jeff. I just enjoyed myself. I caught myself being a listener. And just now, so this whole time, so I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Me too, Scott. You've been everything we'd hoped for, and then some. So, best to you, sir. Rest well, and until we speak again, all the best to you, sir.
Okay, thanks. I look forward to it.
All right, there he goes, folks. Scott, you know, well, what a treat, huh, Greg? Hey, let's take a quick little.
Yes.
That was fun, wasn't it? I mean, the knowledge, he's forgotten more during this phone call than I'll ever know, I suspect. He's just talked to everybody. He's written for everybody. Yeah. Well, let's take a quick little break, and when we come back, we'll do a little jazz flashback, and we've got a new segment, questions and comments from our listeners, which I think people are gonna want to hear. We're listening, folks. We're listening, so stay tuned.
Now, a quick word from our sponsors. Stay tuned. If you dig what you're hearing, friends, why not pick up some Jazz Mill and Soul Message Band merchandise? High-quality mugs and tees that are certain to make you the happiest cat around. Just take out your phone, ease on over to thejazzmill.net, click on the Swag tab, and get your order down. It's quick, it's simple, it's safe, and your satisfaction is 100%. Guarantee.
A portion of sales help jazz musicians against cancer, the Multiple Sclerosis Association of America, and the ASPCA.
Welcome back for more great music and lively discussion on the Jazz Mill with your host, Scott Henderson.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Greg, it's time again for Jazz Flashback. We look back at our history and pay tribute to those that have come before us. What do you have for us, friend?
Okay, today in jazz history, Sonny Rollins recorded A Night at the Village Vanguard with great Elvin Jones and Wilbur Ware. Also, bassist Henry Grimes, his birthday was today in 1935. He was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And Scott, this is especially for you. This is especially for you.
All right.
And I thought about you, and this is
you
I picked this one for you. I sure did. Fats Waller recorded. Fats Waller recorded "Your Feet's Too Big." So, that's for you. I got that one for you.
Ain't that the truth?
And, right. And I want, I want you to know it's yo, Y-O, feets, F-E-E-T-S, too big.
Feet.
Yo, feets too
yeah.
big. That's especially for you there, buddy.
I got to find that. I got to have a copy of that, man. That sounds like a real winner. Oh, that's hysterical. There used to be a song called... had the name of the lady, Caldonia. You remember that song, Caldonia? What makes your big head so hard? Do you remember that one? Does that
yes,
ring any bells?
Sure do. Yeah.
I forget how it goes,
but it was.
She sleeps in the with her head in the kitchen and her feet out in the hall or something like that. It was a clever little lyric. Maybe it's the same damn tune. I don't know. We actually had a dog named Caldonia. We liked it so much we named our Cocker Spaniel after that that tune. Well, good stuff. Thank you for sharing those, Greg. We've got listener questions and comments and voicemails, and people are it tells me that we're catching on. You know, we've got new listeners in France and Brazil and Japan and Thailand, a lot of folks in the States, as you might expect, but we are catching on internationally, which always tickles me. We can see that in our mapping and in our show tracking, and it's just a fun thing to see, to think that we're being heard somewhere in Brazil, sunny Brazil right now. One of the questions, Greg, that we got was, I wish you'd take requests or dedications, will you? And I think the answer should be yes to that, don't you?
I certainly agree. I certainly agree.
If people like a particular tune and they want to hear it by George, I don't see why we couldn't carve out a little bit of time for just exactly that. Another listener asks when we will have Nina Freelon on again. She was a delight, this listener says. And as a matter of fact, Nina will be joining us for our Christmas special. We're going to play her wonderful Christmas holidays album, CD, record on the 22nd of December. So you'll want to mark your calendars for that. We'll be promoting that ahead of air, of course. Someone asked here, Greg, why isn't Elijah Rock playing giant venues? With his kind of talent, he ought to be. And boy, do I agree with that. He has every bit of the skill set of a Michael Bublé or a Harry Connick Jr. I mean, this guy, I think, is going to take off. And, I'm proud to have had him on our broadcast here. And he's just got that it factor, don't you think, Greg?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm trying to do my part because he's such a wonderful guy, such a nice guy. And
totally.
Also, I'm trying to pull some interest in Chicago. He deserves to be here in Chicago, and I've been talking to some people, and I wish I could do more, but with club owners, they're club owners, and they know what they want, and sometimes it's just hard to nail them down, and not that the club owners here wouldn't want Elijah. I just want to make sure that they listen or they take the time, because they get thousands and thousands of bookings. But this guy is special, and all they have to do is sit down and just listen and check out his website, and then no more talking has to be done. He'll sell himself. But
couldn't agree more.
Just to make sure that they would make up their own mind, and he would be here in Chicago. But I'm not going to stop until I see Elijah here in Chicago, because he definitely deserves it. So whoever said that, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, that was Steve in Cleveland that heard the show, and I think he is already a fan to be sure, and he thinks he's worthy of much much bigger venues. Now he's playing some nice spaces, but you know, you look at I hate to pick on Bublé, but he's filling up not stadiums, but they're 10,000 seaters and above. And I just see that for Elijah. I think he's got that kind of star power, and he treats his songs vocally a little different than everybody else too. I mean, there's a little quiver in his approach to them that I think is really interesting and refreshing. I mean, everybody's kind of covering them the same way, it seems like, but he's got a little different angle on it, and he's not averse to trying some different instrumentation, which evidenced in that one he cut from Nashville, which we played a few tracks from. Well, that's great, Greg. Believe me, I'll be in the front row of that show whenever it gets booked. Believe me, I'll be there. And then we had someone. This is Catherine from Miami. She says, I'd like to nominate John Armato for the best beard in jazz. And he does have a sweet ass beard. I'll tell you, you look at his headshots, and man, that thing is gorgeous. It's perfect. It ain't a hair out of place. I wish I could do that. I can't though. I can't do it. Mine just doesn't grow in right. Lastly, want to encourage people to write in freely with your questions and comments. We're always looking to improve and bring you more value. But someone remembered, says, you teased it last week, so when are we going to hear your Hank Stram imitation? And for those of you who don't know who Hank Stram is, he was the Kansas City Chief head coach back in the 60s and early 70s, and he was a funny little character. He was a little short man, and he'd twitchy, and he'd charge around the sideline, and he was super animated, and he was mic'd up for the first Super Bowl by NFL Films, and they caught all of his carrying on the sidelines, and I suggested that I do a bad imitation of him, and it looks like somebody here wants me to do it. I don't know if I should or not. Greg, what do you think?
Okay. So we're going to end this show. No, I'm just kidding. I want to hear that imitation.
Right?
Come on. Now
okay,
I got it. Right.
Let me hear it.
I want to hear it.
Give me a second. See, I got to shake that off. I got to get into character here for a second. Just give me.
Wasn't
give me,
letting
me
you get away without doing that. Give that listener. Yeah, we got to hear that.
All right, my imitation of Hank Stram goes something like this. Okay, Lenny, they couldn't stop us with a Mack truck. Just give them the old spinner, kid. Pop it right in there. Yeah, that's the ticket. And that's it. And that's it. That's my Stram. That's my Stram.
That was great. That was great.
Listen, if it sounds as good on the air as it does in my head, I'm on to something. I might be on to something.
That was great.
I don't know. I can't play an instrument, but maybe I could take this Hank Stram thing on the road. Who knows? Well, Greg,
no, that was great. That was great.
Pump it right in there, Lenny. Give him the old spinner, kid.
That was great. You sound like two
different
people.
Don't get me started. Susan, my poor wife, I mean, I slip into characters sometimes, and it's not so easy to get out of them. You know what I mean? I'm walking around the house and in Hank Stram character, and bless her heart, she should get a medal or something. But hey, listen.
That was great, Scott. That was great.
Yeah,
that was great.
You're too kind, sir. You're too kind. hey, Scott Yano was terrific. You too, Greg. Awesome today. And, of course, we want to thank our listeners for tuning in this time and every time to the Jazz Mill. If you dig it, folks, tell your friends about us, won't you please? Greg, signing off here, I'm going to play a little of Ramsey Lewis's Satin Doll. I think this is a particularly nice version of that, and I'll play our listeners out. Keep swinging, folks. I know that you will.
Mm-hmm.